So last week, Shinta mentioned that I'd given him an impossible task of explaining the hard part of Paramount in one lecture, but I've given myself sort of a more impossible task, right, which is to sort of introduce the whole notion of renormalization in physics and somehow wind up explaining what that has to do with Ricci flow. So I'm convinced I can't do this in one lecture, and I'm sorry for that. Let me mention a reference. So there's some very nice lectures by Krzysztof Gawicki, and this is in the big two-volume Quantum Fields and Strings from the special year at IAS that we had 10 years ago in 1996-97, volume 2. So because I didn't copy the first page, I don't actually know the title of his lectures, but I think they were called Lectures on Conformal Field Theory. And in particular, I'm going to try to talk some about materialists covered in Lecture 3, which is, by the way, this is Quantum Fields and Strings, a something for mathematicians. I can't. You would think since I helped choose the title, I would be able to remember it. Pardon? No. I think it's called A Guide for Mathematicians or something. That's the name of the book. And Lecture 3 is about sigma models. So, yeah, and also I recognize that this room has, you know, it's half full of people who completely know everything I'm going to say, and it's half full of people who are going to disbelieve everything I say. So my task is interesting. So what do you do in classical physics? Well, the formulation which people often use to describe classical physics is there's some kind of fields, classical fields, that are described in the theory, and there's some functional of these fields, usually called the action functional of these fields, and the classical way of arriving at physical principles is to find the action with the property that the stationary values of the action correspond to the actual physical states of the theory. So, you know, you can write Newton's laws in this form, you can write electromagnetism in this form, and what these lead to are natural equations, partial differential equations typically, for the fields that are involved in the action. And to try to solve those fields is to determine the physical states of the theory. So the there's time dependence as well as space dependence in the equations that one ends up writing down. So quantum physics was hard to find, and one of the reasons that quantum physics was hard to find is that quantum physics approximates classical physics very well at certain in certain regimes, certain distance and energy scales. And so even though in the 20th century people realized that the traditional way of describing physics that was studied very intensively up through the end of the 19th century had to be replaced by quantum physics, really that replacement is an improvement in the approximation rather than a wholesale replacement. But it's often presented, I mean, one would kind of like to think of starting with the classical physical theory and arriving at the quantum description of that classical physical theory, but actually the correspondence properly goes in the opposite order. If you have found an accurate description of a quantum theory, you can compute the so-called classical or semi-classical limit of that theory, and you wouldn't call it a quantum version of the classical theory unless you got the classical theory you were aiming for. But the reverse, the process of starting with the classical theory and finding the quantum one, is more of an art than a science at the present time, maybe for all time. And it's not clear how unique the process of finding a quantum version of a theory is, or how to generally set about doing it. But the version of quantum theories I want to talk about, again, describes the same action of the same fields, typically. But instead of worrying about calculating critical values of that action, one tries to calculate physical quantities which depend on some... So there are various physical quantities in the physical system. They'll depend on some function of the fields. And then what you're supposed to integrate is... So I'm going to use mathematician's order of this. I'll make one comment about that in a second. What you're supposed to integrate is something like this. The action of the field, the action evaluated on the field goes in the exponent of an exponential weighted by this funny constant, the expansion constant called h bar, and then one puts a measure of the field. Now, I often make a joke that you can tell whether it's a physicist or a mathematician by whether the measure comes first in the integrand or not. So physicists will often write this with the measure first in the integrand. I don't have any idea why. There are those two conventions. Pardon?
Interval d phi is an operator which replies some object.
Okay. That's very sensible. I don't know why we don't do it that way. Right. And what one is trying to think of doing is, for example, integrating over all maps from... So here we just had, you know, these fields lived in some space-time, and maybe we're describing what was happening in this space-time. Let me call that space-time M for a second. In this context, we want to think of doing an integral over all maps from sigma. So sigma, we imagine, is what's called the world line of a particle. So it's a one-dimensional object. And we're trying to think of all possible ways that that particle could have evolved within the space-time. So the classical version of the theory says, just extremize the action, and you will find the path that the physical particle travels. In the quantum version, one is supposed to not just extremize the action, but one is supposed to take contributions from all possible paths, including the path from here to the chair which went to Alpha Centauri and back in between, right? And weight those somehow according to the action in an interval of this kind. In this process, the phi is to be thought of, well, so phi is some function a priori on the space-time M, and this measure phi you're trying to think of as being a product of things that look like little d phis, except the little d phis are labeled by x's in sigma. So I'm asking people to do an integral whose number of variables is the number of points on a line, which is a hard thing to do. And in fact, it's worse than a hard thing to do. It's not a thing that anybody has a good definition for doing, and it's one of the reasons why mathematicians have a lot of trouble with this entire approach to doing physics. So this is the Feynman path integral formulation of a physical theory based on an action, and it sort of suffers right away from this problem of not even being able to say what the measure means that you're using to do the integral.
Did you say what f is?
F is some function. So the simplest case is when f is identically 1, then the answer to this integral is called the partition function. But there are more complicated cases where you just insert some function of the fields. So let me just do this in an extremely simple example. So let's consider a case where I'll just leave that. Let's consider a case where the action is just quadratic. So I don't know why people put a beta in there, but there's some constant that is typical. So you can take the norm squared of the derivative of the field plus some quadratic term times the volume on the world line, volume element on the world line. And we can think of that sort of more intrinsically as being the field contracted with some operator, a Green's operator type thing, where the Green's operator is pretty simple in this case. It just looks like maybe beta over 2 pi times the Green's operator looks like minus delta plus m squared inverse. Some natural looking operator which produces this kind of action. So what one then wants to do to calculate this...
Do you want the inverse on the second, right, on the
right-hand side? On the... No. Thank you.
And you want a phi on the right-hand side?
I want a phi on the right-hand side. Well, no. So what's the partition function look like in a case like this? The partition function is just going to be this integral e to the s of phi d phi. And so it looks like a Gaussian integral with some quadratic expression. This is some quadratic operator there. And if this were finite dimensional, then the answer is just the determinant to the 1/2. Okay? That's just you diagonalize the quadratic form and you discover, you separate variables, you do Gaussian integrals for each one, and then, you know, taking the product, the invariant way of writing that down is that it was the determinant of the operator. So one would like to do a similar thing in infinite dimensions. There is not a unique way to do it, so there's one has to choose what's called a regularization scheme for the problem. So let's use what's called zeta function regularization. So in zeta function regularization, what we imagine doing is taking the eigenvalues of G, noticing that the rough growth rate of those eigenvalues is like n to the minus 2 over a. So I guess I should generalize the setup that I'm looking at to cases of more interest. So the original Feynman formulation in quantum field theory is for a so-called one-dimensional quantum field theory. That's going to be the case where we imagine that the particle is sweeping out a world line in one dimension. But what I'm actually going to be talking about today is mainly two-dimensional quantum field theories, but let's do this calculation in d plus 1 dimensions. The reason you write it as d plus 1 is you think of 1 as being the time dimension and d is telling you how many spatial dimensions you have. So the growth rate of the spectrum of the Laplacian should be like, I mean, there's this mass term, but that doesn't affect things too much, should be like n to the minus 2 over d plus 1. And then there's a natural regularization. You can define a zeta function-like object, which is just the sum of the eigenvalues to the minus s, that converges when the real part of s is big. I forgot to write down what the constant is, and it has an analytic continuation to the origin. So you just define this to be the determinant of G. And maybe log, sorry. And And maybe minus.
Does it mean that you one? Maybe it always gets the sum of one.
Is the derivative?
It has.
The zeta differentiated, and then you have it.
Yeah, maybe. Let me look back and what I was taking notes from. Help.
You can just check by differentiate that theta function term by term.
Right.
If you differentiate it, then you get a log of lambda out of that.
So this is what I want, right?
Yeah.
Okay. The point is, this is some formal way of making this guy converge. It's a formal way to do something which would agree with the finite dimensional case. It's not the only possible choice, but it's one possible choice of extracting an answer out of an integral like this. So one lesson to be learned from this little exercise is that the actual answers are going to depend somehow on the regularization schemes, potentially. And what one hopes is that quantities like ratios of answers won't depend on regularization schemes. Or more generally, as I will talk about, there's this process of renormalization that one goes through, and one hopes that the end point of renormalization, or the quantities that one is extracting from renormalization, again, will be independent of choice of regularization and renormalization schemes. So the formal integral, which got half erased here, which is the basic approach to studying these quantum theories, this integral over a space of maps, is something which doesn't make sense on the face of it mathematically, which can be somehow approximated and controlled in certain circumstances, and it's it's certain limits in those approximation schemes that give information that can be extracted out of this kind of setup. In the early days of my own learning of this subject, I heard a physicist address mathematicians on this subject, and he sort of presented it in the following way. He said, a quantum field theory is a table of integrals. So what's a table of integrals? A table of integrals has some integrals done out completely, tells you what the answer is, some general schemes which tell you how to transform some integrals into other integrals, and what's missing from this table of integrals is the textbook which told you how to derive all the formulas, right? So we don't know how to get the correct, we don't know correct derivations of all of the formulas that are used, but there is a, by now, probably almost 60 or 70 year history of manipulating integrals of this kind in ways that produce physically meaningful answers, and in many cases the test of physical meaningfulness was by direct comparison with experiment. So the theory of quantum electrodynamics, the quantum theory of the electromagnetic force, is extremely well tested. One uses these funny manipulations of infinite quantities to produce infinite series that don't necessarily even converge, but whose first several terms give amazing agreement with experiments that are done in laboratories. And for this reason, it's one of the standard toolkits of the modern theoretical physicist, even though it makes mathematicians kind of uncomfortable. So the basic problem that we want to consider, which is related to this topic of Ricci flow, is the problem of these quantum field theories, and now D plus 1 is going to be 2. Two-dimensional quantum field theories from mapping some surface into some M, which is going to be a Riemannian manifold. And in a minute, I'm going to have to equip my Riemannian manifold with an extra function or two, and maybe also a form of top degree. functions from two-dimensional field theory into a Riemannian manifold, out of which one wants to build an action. So what's the natural action principle to look at? Well, so I have to give you an action which takes values on a map from the surface into the Riemannian manifold. And Riemannian manifold means that I'm giving you a metric Gij to begin with. So the standard thing that you write down for an action maybe what I need to do is just spread everything out. I lost my page with the single model action. There it is. The reason I wanted to look it up is I wanted to get the 1 over 4 pi correct. There are constants which are standard to put in the physics literature. So what I want to do is take the L2 norm of the differential of this map from one space to the other. And if you write that out, add in components, it looks like 1 over 2 pi times an integral over sigma of the metric times coordinates. So in components, it looks like this. A sort of more invariant way of writing down the action is this. It's the simplest thing you can form that will involve the metric, the pullback of the metric, to the surface sigma. Now, it turns out that people often add three other terms to this action. So this is the most natural thing you might have thought of writing down when you had a Riemannian manifold. There's a so-called topological term, which I'm going to ignore for the most part. Pardon?
Is that area?
Yes.
The surface acquires an area by pulling back.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
That's not the area because it's a symmetric. Oh, it's related. That's like the Nambu form of the action.
I don't know what this I is in this formula. I think that I is a typo. In the topological term, one puts an I. So there's a topological term, which is the pullback of some top degree form on M. So this is a top degree differential. Sorry, this is a two form on M. Yeah, it's area squared, something like that. Right. So that's a natural form that you can, a natural term that you can to add to these things. It's going to be suppressed from the formulas that I give today. And then there are two other terms. There's a term involving a field, a function U on the manifold M, which looks like 1 over 4 pi times the integral of U composed with phi times the volume on sigma. So I can just put in a term like that. And then there's another one, a function W. And the term that I would put for the W is W composed with phi times the scalar curvature on sigma, d vol sigma. So there are these other possible terms. And this one's called a tachyon. And this one's called a dilaton. They have names.
Well, not every term is called a particle.
Well, I mean, in your case, you name these terms as if the things that end with O-M.
That's right.
So we'll wipe all your
this is a graviton. This is a tachyonodilton. Actually, I don't know a word ending in on for the topological term.
It's like an axion.
I guess it is an axion, isn't it? Yeah.
But I mean, I think of a particle as some kind of excitation in a field. So, in some sense, is what's the translation of terminal Lagrangian is named after a particle because at some point.
So,
anyone in the audience speak up?
are we integrating over U and all possible U and W, or are they fixed?
So,
when we define the action.
So the action has as inputs a choice of metric, a choice of U, a choice of W, and a choice of omega. Mm-hmm. Right. And those are the basic parameters in this family of Lagrangians. And what we're about to do is try to figure out how renormalization affects the choice of parameters. The answer, I think, to your question is the application of this of these results to string theory. So when you're looking at string theory, you're attempting to encode what's happening in a 10-dimensional world in 2-dimensional terms. And it turns out that these terms in the Lagrangian are related to the behavior of some 10-dimensional space-time action. And it's the so that's the M here. And so it's the behavior in M in the ultimate theory that one is deriving from this conformal field theory that motivates the names.
In particular, GIJ is the metric on the 10-dimensional space that the string is moving through. So,
right. So from the 10-dimensional point of view, these guys, GIJ, U, W, and omega, are dynamical fields. So they're regarded as varying in space-time. But from the point of view of this approximation, we fix a choice of those things, fix a so-called space-time background, and then try to study what the sigma model would look like in that background. And so that's motivated the name. So it's not directly related to the physics of sigma models that I'm discussing here, but rather to the application in perturbative string theory. So I'd like to think of a way of making sense of integrals like this in this context. And so, again, I'm integrating over maps from sigma into M. And, you know, if this had just been a quadratic function of the field, then I could have used that zeta function regularization and done the Gaussian integral and sort of been happy with the answer. But this is a much more complicated setup. In particular, it involves potentially an arbitrary Riemannian manifold. So there are several issues. One is the need for a regularization scheme, just to kind of make sense of the integrals at all. And the other is the need for something known as renormalization. So let me talk a little bit about renormalization. It's too hard to actually do the entire integral. And so one imagines approximating the integral by some approximation method that would pay attention to features at certain distance scales, but not at features at other distance scales. Not to features at other distance scales. So one way that one often imagines doing this is by a lattice approximation to sigma. So in this context of a two-dimensional sigma, I could imagine chopping sigma into some two-dimensional lattice. And now the problem that I have an uncountably infinite number of variables to integrate over goes away. At worst, in this kind of approximation scheme, I have a countable number of variables to integrate over. And maybe I'll even just take some large box as well so that I have a finite number of variables to integrate over. And then it makes perfect sense to talk about these integrals. So I sort of replace this by an integral over maps from some discretized version of sigma into m, and now the measure makes complete sense. So this is a well-defined integral. And that integral, well, it's well-defined, but of course, I mean, so, you know, I've just written down something roughly like a Riemann sum. So there's a lot of technical work to be done to make sure that the kind of results that we extract from this don't depend on the choice of lattice regularization or anything of the sort. I'm actually not going to be doing the lattice regularization when I make a computation, and so this discussion is slightly irrelevant, but the sort of simple answer to questions like have people checked the independence of choice of scheme or the independence of method of regularization, whether we use lattice or some other way, the independence of the answers to choices like that, the answer is generally no. So generally, because there's an underlying belief that the infinite integral does make sense somehow, one tries to find a computationally effective scheme for evaluating it, and then if one is lucky, one can find two different schemes and at least compare two different forms of the answer, but often one settles for having done it one time and gotten all the way to the end, and declares that to be the answer. So, I'm not trying to denigrate the results. I'm just trying to point out the difficulties in thinking about this as rigorous mathematics. But,
I think it actually doesn't work. I mean, that it even think about lattice regularization for like a Chern-Simons theory. Maybe someone should correct me if I'm wrong. But for instance, if you look at the Witten's formula for knot invariance using an integral, you know, an integral trace of polynomial over the space of connections, if you treat that formula as if it could be evaluated as a Riemann sum, you wouldn't expect anything exciting to happen when a crossing occurred, because the holonomy of the principal bundle over the knot would only change slightly as a crossing occurred. That would change continuously. Yet the answer to the computation is supposed to jump, of course, with the crossing. So, you know, somehow, you know, this makes sense when you complete the square and you know, get a two-point function into play,
mm-hmm.
and then you see that something exciting is happening when two points are brought close together. But if you just treat the original integral as something that you try to throw on the lattice and approximate, if you thought that way, you would exclude the possibility that it defined a non-invariant.
It's true that lattice regularization tends to be less useful in trying to approximate something that has a diffeomorphism invariant symmetry. Because the lattice breaks that symmetry and you change the properties.
That's an example. That's what I said is an example.
Exactly.
Right. Right.
And that's always a trick. Any regularization scheme, you have to be careful to preserve the symmetries that are really important to you. It's part of the game.
Right.
I mean, this point was what impressed me most when I first saw Witten's paper, because it looked to me like the formula was obviously not a non-invariant.
Yeah.
So the first thing I thought of, well, he must be pretty smart to know that that's a good formula.
Right. So, I guess I'm describing lattice regularization because the point of renormalization can be easily described in this language. And so I'm going to, even though it's not appropriate for all problems, I'm going to finish this description. And then we'll switch regularization schemes for the actual problem we're looking at here. So you can do the integral, but the integral will depend on the distance scale of the lattice, which is often called the cutoff, lambda. And the idea of renormalization is that if one considers the family of theories in which the constants quote-unquote constants in S are varied. So the constants in our action are a choice of Riemannian metric on the target space, of a couple of functions on the target space, and a two-form on the target space. But if you take the family of theories in which the constants are varied, then it's sometimes possible to find lambda-dependent choices of these constants in such a way that the limit as lambda goes to the convention for the cutoff is that the limit that we care about is lambda goes to infinity. The limit is lambda goes to infinity of the quantities like the integral of f e to the minus 1 over h bar s d phi when the lambda-dependent versions of the terms in the action are substituted in, that these limits exist. So even with a regularization scheme, we're not going to get finite answers typically. Typically, when we try to take the regularization scheme and take a limit as the cutoff, the spacing of the lattice perhaps is something like 1 over lambda, as the cutoff the way I've regularized it goes to infinity, typically those integrals won't exist. But it may be possible to modify the terms in a lambda-dependent way to make the thing exist. So what one wants to do is calculate the lambda dependence, the cutoff dependence of these integrals on lambda to determine what kinds of lambda-valued functions, lambda-dependent constants one should choose for the family of theories, and that process is called renormalization. So in the space of all possible constants, I can imagine that this process determines a certain flow where as lambda varies, given a starting value, I have to choose some family of parameters. And this flow, one hopes, has attractor points so that the general behavior will be that the family of theories does approach some well-defined limit. Often that limit is actually outside the space of theories that you're studying, and so the only way that you have of extracting information about the limiting theory, the fully renormalized theory, is by this process, this limiting process, and figuring out the behavior of those constants. And those constants, quote-unquote constants, as functions of the parameter lambda. Now, prior to Dan Friedan's thesis in 1980, people studied families of theories in which the family itself was only finite dimensional. But Friedan realized that it could make sense in some context, and it was necessary, certainly if you wanted to study all possible sigma models on Riemannian manifolds, to allow an infinite dimensional parameter space for the theory. So even if I fix the topological type of the manifold, the set of possible metrics on that is an extremely large space, as are the sets of functions here. We could still try to calculate what the flow would be within the space of theories, and it's that calculation which led to this Ricci flow equation as being related to these two-dimensional theories. So the next thing I have to try to explain is the perturbation expansion. And in other words, I have to try to explain the role of H-bar in these theories. So the H-bar goes to zero limit is supposed to restore the classical theory. In fact, it's stationary values of the action that are important. In the H bar, it goes to zero limit. This is an E, obviously. One could hope for certain families of theories to express the answer either to the cutoff integral or to the final integral as some kind of power series in H. So there's a first term, there's a second term, there's a third term, and I'm never going to go beyond first power. So we could hope to sort of figure out the H-bar dependence and write things in this form. Now, whether or not this is a reasonable thing to do depends on lots of features of this this theory, and in particular, you know, whether this is a good approximation will depend heavily on the behavior of the higher order terms, and there may in fact be contributions, important contributions, which are not polynomial in H bar, but maybe have some kind of exponential dependence, you know, e to the minus 1 over H bar squared type dependence, where you would get contributions to terms like that that weren't polynomial in H bar. All those things have to be worried about in thinking about a perturbative approach to these kind of theories. But the basic H-bar dependence is being treated often in this way. So to try to outline Friedan's calculation for you.
Sorry.
Yes, sure.
So there are two things we're supposed to be keeping track of. One is lambda and one is H-bar.
Yeah. That's right.
So
there are, for example, order of limits problems that we won't discuss.
I'm not worried about it, but just for that, to understand that formula, that perturbative expansion, I'm imagining lambda fixed.
Let's imagine lambda fixed, right? So these are lambda-dependent quantities as well. And then we'll try to kind of deal with those quantities individually. So the regularization scheme, which one usually uses in this calculation, is something called dimensional regularization. So I just want to outline the remaining ingredients that we have to talk about. This is called dimensional regularization. In dimensional regularization, you take the dimension of sigma to be its actual dimension plus epsilon, and then you let epsilon go to zero. Well, this turns out to be, so what does it mean to take the dimension to be epsilon? It means, you know, for example, this volume thing will get raised to some power, for example, because if the number of variables had been 2 plus epsilon instead of 2, you would have had a slightly different power of the volume. And it turns out that for these two-dimensional sigma models, there are a number of interesting quantities which have poles of the form one. If you write them as a function of dimension, they have poles of the form 1 over the dimension, the total dimension of sigma, which is little d plus 1, minus 2. And since we're interested in the two-dimensional case, those poles are very important to us. So that's why kind of being able to think of the dimension as being 2 plus epsilon is important. That's actually going to be a clue in the renormalization process to what sorts of effects are causing divergences in the integrals and have to be compensated for by making lambda-dependent changes in the constants Gij. So that's one thing that we have to understand. The renormalization scheme that one uses is called minimal subtraction. So I'm using this notation now, Fj, which depended on lambda, times h to the j as representing the perturbation coefficient. I have to explain somehow how to separate out the contributions of the integral into terms like that. But this particular kind of coefficient, and now it's really the epsilon, which is, well, let me just say it's a function of epsilon instead of worrying about the lambda for a second. This particular coefficient has got term, a sort of bare term that looks like 1 over d plus 1, well, 1 over epsilon, the way I've just phrased it, times some polar term plus terms that are regular in epsilon. So you only find simple poles as a function of epsilon, and you just Taylor expand the quantity and look at the polar term, and now you want to subtract off just the polar term. Well, what you're allowed to modify are the g and the u, so it's actually hard to explain what I'm saying until I've written out what the answers to these things are. But you make calculations in the partition function. There, these terms involve things like a change in Gij, and it's those changes in Gij which you're setting equal to certain values in order to make sure that the poles cancel.
Is there always a unique way to cancel them?
I'm calling a minimal subtraction because, of course, I would be allowed to put in plus epsilon times whatever I like, right?
No, what I mean is, there you're saying you're varying the metric to cancel the 1 over epsilon. Could you also vary, say, u or w and cancel the same term?
So the reason that I got forced to put in the u is that it turns out that sometimes you need a u to cancel something that was apparent in the metric. But it turns out that the W and the omega can be suppressed for the purposes of doing this computation. So the set of all G's and U's is a renormalization invariant set of theories. That's all that you need to do in order to make this calculation. So there's a particular regularization scheme, a particular renormalization scheme, and now the fact is that the computation of F1 of epsilon leads to the Ricci flow equation. So that's only taking care of the first pole, which would appear. And in fact, people have worked out that they're so people were very excited for a while because the polar parts after the h go like 0 h bar squared and 0 h bar cubed, but then there turns out to be a non-zero term for h bar to the fourth. So the kind of full physical answer would be some modification of the Ricci flow equation in an h bar dependent way. And then we get into this sort of two-parameter dynamical system. I don't really know how to talk about it. Moreover, I believe there's one paper which addresses something about the fifth order term, but there are no computations that have been made for terms beyond this first level. So the problem which is directly related to the Ricci flow problem is the so-called one-loop term in this renormalization equation. The number of loops refers to the power of h bar and comes from an interpretation in terms of Feynman diagrams, which in the short amount of time I have today, I doubt I will say much about. I'm sorry?
Only 40 years of quantum field theory
in an hour and a half. Yes, correct, right.
The Ricci flow is on the metric. What happens to the function?
Okay, Mike wants to jump to the end. And I'm happy to do that, actually.
Well, I was wondering if it had anything to do with the function of the first lecture.
It does. Perlman makes this point that he's motivated to introduce this additional function by what Friedan did, but he doesn't explain. He claims not to understand too well what Friedan did, and he doesn't explain any further other than just the motivation. But the eventual terms turn out to be like this. So the variation in the metric has to go like the Ricci, and the variation in U has to go like the Laplacian of U. So I guess it is possible to just set U equals zero from the beginning and flow purely in the space of metrics. But there are lots of cases in which one sort of wants to consider G I J as well as U. And it's also not clear to me, I guess, that things would separate quite as nicely if you also include the higher loop corrections, the for loop correction, and so on. I'm not at all sure that's true. So this is the sort of outcome of the computation.
I think it's also when you include dilaton.
Pardon?
Is that when you include the dilaton? Because then the metric data function actually changes. I don't know that that was in Friedan's thesis.
All I can tell you is that that's not in the notes that I'm looking at.
No, I think it came after the second one.
Yeah, there's the del I del j dilaton term, right? In the metric beta function.
Yeah.
And that wasn't understood until 1886.
Okay. Right.
Friedan just did the metric. Certainly, he wasn't thinking about the dilaton. He was really doing field theory. He wasn't. I mean, he may have had string theory vaguely in mind, but all that understanding of the dilaton and stuff like that came much later in the mid-80s when people sort of revisited those with that sort of normalization group approach.
So I was going to try to explain the computation a little bit, but in order to do it, I have to explain the Feynman diagram expansion in general, and I only have 35 minutes, and I'm not thinking of a good way to summarize that quickly. So I think what I want to do is open the floor for discussion and come back and have another lecture in which I do Feynman diagrams in more detail, because I don't think I have time to do Feynman diagrams today. Any more questions or discussion? Maybe we'll just have an hour today. Yes? Yeah?
This stuff applies to just regular quantum field theory. Is this stuff only with strings, or is it?
No. What I was setting up for you is how one thinks about quantum field theories, and so the relationship between quantum field theory and string theory in this context is that the perturbative approach to string theory involves making computations of two-dimensional quantum field theories. There you want a restricted class of quantum field theories which are conformally invariant, which in this context essentially means that they're scale invariant, so that the renormalization won't change anything. What that really means is that to find quantum field theories that are relevant in string theory, we should be trying to look for fixed points of this renormalization method. And as I mentioned, finding fixed points directly is extremely difficult, and so one often approaches the task of describing a two-dimensional conformal field theory by starting with something that isn't renormalization invariant, but that one has good reason to believe at the endpoint of renormalization will be one of the conformal field theories one wants, and then calculate things figure out their renormalization dependence, or maybe show that certain quantities are independent of renormalization, and be confident that those will give you the right answers at the end. There's another approach to studying conformal field theories, a limited class of conformal field theories, and that is to exploit the beautiful algebraic structure of conformal field theories and to use representation theory of the algebras involved to write down explicit conformal field theories. And the finite dimensional representation theory of those algebras is under good control, but most conformal field theories are infinite dimensional representations of those algebras, and we don't have as good control over those guys. Yes?
The higher corrections or contributions to the beta function for G, do they have any geometrical meaning in the sense of the Ricci flows? Do they improve the idea of the Ricci flows somehow, or in the geometrical context?
Yeah,
we discussed earlier.
Right. I don't know the answer to that question. I don't think... So what this means is taking the Ricci flow and modifying the equation slightly with some higher curvature terms. It's only very recently that people have made substantial progress on the Ricci flow itself. I don't think that those higher curvature terms would modify the short time existence theorems that the Ricci flow has, but to what extent they might modify some of the other aspects of Ricci flow, particularly the surgery aspect or the long time behavior, is completely unknown, I think. Yes?
So when you said that there's no h bar squared and h bar cubed terms, you're thinking that the first correction is an r to the fourth term?
Yeah, isn't that the...
Well, that's true for the superstring, but for the bosonic string, you have r squared.
I see. Sorry. So this was in the super case. Thanks.
I was just going to add, one of the points of this in a for dancing is a way to find conformal field theories is to just demand that those variations with scale are identical to zero.
That's right. So had it turned out to be true in the super case that all the higher corrections vanished, then Ricci flat would have always produced a conformally invariant theory. What we know now is that Ricci flat metrics produce something which is conformally invariant to first order in the perturbation expansion, but needs some sort of corrections if one is going to go beyond first order. And by the way, that's still, to me, a somewhat puzzling aspect of the whole program, because if you start from the 10-dimensional point of view, then you calculate Ricci flat as a necessary condition for space-time supersymmetry, and that was great until people had found this for loop result, right? Because it seemed like there was a perfect match between the space-time approach and the world sheet approach. Now we understand that from the world sheet approach, the perturbative string theory would need modification of the Ricci flat metric, and that suggests that what we already knew, which was that the supergravity approximation in the space-time approach isn't completely accurate. It also needs to be corrected. Yes?
Well, that sounds like it suggests a problem in differential geometry. I mean, so there must be a condition which replaces Ricci flat, which takes these higher curvatures into account.
And it's a condition that depends on a parameter, because h-bar, I mean, there will be this sort of family of...
Okay, so right. We could ask, if a manifold has a metric which is Ricci flat, does it have a metric which satisfies this generalized condition for each parameter body?
Right. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is that, in fact, that might be an infinite series and it might not be a convergent series. And problem number three is it might have terms, it might not be analytic at the origin, so it might not be equal to its Taylor expansion. Mm-hmm. But it's actually a great opportunity for differential geometry, because if differential geometry could find some parameter-dependent natural object which agreed with Ricci flow to first order, and maybe one would also want to check that if one tried to force a Taylor expansion and looked at the h-bar of the fourth term, that you would get the right thing there, then that would suggest itself as the natural candidate for the non-perturbative formulation of the right thing. That problem's been in the air for quite a while, and I think it's been stated to mathematicians in the form that I just stated it before, and nobody's really come up with the natural thing to use.
So you say that they know that there are these non-zero higher order terms, that people have gone through and computed I mean, the fourth order correction and seeing if there are non-trivial fixed points? I mean, or is that just, that calculation hasn't been done? Mm-hmm. I mean, presumably if those terms aren't zero, then there are going to be corrections to that flow equation.
Do you know,
yeah,
Gary?
Yeah. Sure. I mean, so the for loop term has been computed. Mm-hmm. It's known explicitly. It's some complicated, you know, r to the fourth type term in the Lagrangian. And people have actually computed its effect perturbatively on certain solutions. You start with a solution which is Ricci flat, and now you look at perturbations about that which solve this modified equation with an r to the fourth term added. And that's been done for certain backgrounds. The problem which always comes up is that physically, these r to the fourth terms, if the curvature is small compared to some natural scale set by this, you know, h-bar parameter, or what we usually call alpha prime, but if the curvature is small set compared to the scale, then of course the corrections to the metric are small. Okay. What would be more interesting is to ask what happens when those corrections are not so small. But just when those corrections start being appreciable, all the other higher order terms that you haven't computed yet are going to be equally appreciable, and you don't have any control over it. So,
except in some cases where there's some large topological memory that you can balance against some of these.
Yes, okay, so there are some cases where you can actually argue that the sort of next term is important, but the other ones are not as important.
Actually, an example that's well understood is just the 2D O3 sigma model on the sphere with precisely the theta term, the topological term at angle pi, even though nobody can do the calculation, but it's known to have a fixed point in two dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
So in principle, one could think of sort of calculating the metric and figuring out how it renormalizes jointly with the effects of a topological term. But this is not understood perturbatively. This is understood only non-perturbatively, yeah, using some other techniques in the probability.
Presumably, it's such a non-perturbative in H-point.
Yeah. Right. So, non-perturbative effects mean things that would cause that function of H-bar not to be analytic, not to equal this Taylor series.
And there are also solutions which are known, in particular some that Gary looked at, which are known to exist to all orders in this because of some extra symmetries in the problem.
Yeah, so you can argue that there are certain solutions for which all these higher order terms vanish. Okay, that's a particularly nice class of solutions.
Well, like flat, for example.
Well, flat. Yeah. But there are non-flat solutions for which all the higher order terms vanish, the so-called plane waves.
Mm-hmm.
And the curvature is null.
In the large radius expansion where you can neglect the higher order terms?
What's that?
Take the large radius expansion.
Well, the large radius expansion is the usual case. That you know, people think about where the curvature is just small everywhere compared to this, you know, scale. So the higher order terms are small, and you can justify ignoring them.
Mm-hmm.
But there are cases where they are strictly zero. Mm-hmm. So you get exact solutions to all orders in this expansion.
The curvatures are not small, but the invariants are, I guess.
That's right. So there are these so-called exact plane wave solutions of general relativity.
Mm-hmm.
Where the curvature is null in a suitable sense, so all the powers of it that you have to compute here vanish, even though the curvature itself is not zero.
So let me just, it's elementary point, make sure I understand what you're saying about renormalization.
Mm-hmm.
So are you saying that if I take this high-dimensional manifold, and I Ricci flow it, then if I look at some surface mapping into the flowed manifold, I should compute basically the same energy as I would get by mapping a coarse version of the surface into the original manifold.
Well, the...
A Riemann sum kind of coarsening.
The mapping will depend... the value will depend on the coarsening parameter in some predictable way.
But that should tell me how long I Ricci flow. So in other words, I have these two things I can do. I can, with a surface, I can make it coarser, namely look at it at longer line scales or take a discretization where the points are farther apart. So I have this way of coarsening the surface, and then I have this way of sort of relaxing an ambient manifold,
right,
which is Ricci flow.
Right.
And my impression of what you were saying is that they're kind of adjoint to each other.
That's right.
Okay. Not exactly.
Let's assume one loop is exact. I mean, that's, in the one loop approximation.
In the fractional loop approximation. Now, this suggests a couple of questions to me. One is, what's so special about surfaces? In other words, suppose we ask the same question, coarse in a one or a three-dimensional manifold, just because those are near two.
Right.
And ask what's the adjoint operation on geometry. So three might be hard, but one should be very trivial. So does it even make sense? What happens if you think about the energy of a circle map into a Riemannian manifold and you coarse in the circle?
Right. So dimensional regularization gave me this kind of pole. So I'm not even sure. So what does it mean?
There's no correction to the geometry.
There's no correction, right?
Because that's ordinary quantum mechanics.
In dimension one.
Dimension one.
Yeah, that's what I was getting to.
So there's no curvature on the line.
Yeah, okay, good.
So there's
okay.
No correction.
Yeah. But in dimension three, it looks like I don't really have a pole there,
true.
Right?
There's no one loop beta function in dimension three. You have to go to.
I believe you have to go to higher loops. Dimension three is not realizable theory, is it?
I see. Wrong power counting.
No, it's. With the metric, I'm not sure. It's super wrong.
Well, the example is again the simple Fermi magnet in three dimensions. So if I take just a three sigma model again, look at it in three dimension, it has a second order phase transition. I said vary the parameter h bar. So in one phase, the geometry is simple, and the other is sort of crumpled. So it just describes the Fermi magnetic transition in a simple statistical mechanics model of a Heisenberg magnet. So that's what this would be if I went up to 3.
Yeah, I'm sorry, did you tell me what replacement function is?
In three dimensions, you're mapping into what?
Well, if I were to map into a sphere as a geometry, right, then so I have only one parameter available, right, I can write everything in this fashion, right? And then the metric would flow, the metric of a sphere, the curvature would flow, and there's a fixed point where the curvature takes a specific value, separating one phase from the other. Right. So, but that's a constrained example where I have so much symmetry that I force the manifold to be a sphere. Right.
But you say the radius of the sphere does flow under normal
dimensions
in three dimensions.
Yeah.
At higher dimensions?
Yeah. All
dimensions.
Right.
Yeah. It's in three dimensions, if I remember right, the one that the other function is no longer. It vanishes. Presumably there's harder.
Well, they balance each other then, right? And so it's a complicated problem, but it's known for physical reasons that there is a transition.
Right. So, Andres, would you say what the model is once more? The manifold that's on.
The manifold is a sphere.
What dimension?
It's two sphere. Let's say
two sphere.
Yeah, as an example,
okay.
Right?
And the spins on it take values in
on the sphere.
On what dimensional sphere?
Two sphere.
M is
a two sphere. Sigma is a three manifold.
Sigma is a three manifold.
Okay.
M is a two sphere.
And M is a two sphere. Okay. And you have a ferromagnetic coupling between the spins.
I write the same sigma model.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Just I force my metric to have a symmetry of a sphere. Let's say so. I have only one parameter. Right? It's a special example. Actually, in all symmetric spaces, we can do similar things and generalize sigma models. But force the target space M to be a highly symmetric space. And we know the answer to this question in 3D.
Mm-hmm. But there is something special about two dimensions, as Dave pointing out, because classically, only in two dimensions, sigma model is conformal. And even another dimension is
only
possible, not
the zero.
So
that's right. It's not
there's a
fixed point of the OG. It turns out you can study. You can follow the epsilon expansion from d plus one, going from two plus epsilon. And you can follow it up, epsilon going to one all the way to, and will match up
but
with
a different question. It's not modifying Ricci flow. It's just a different equation. multiple equation and volumetric.
It has a non. Okay.
Zero power.
It has a trivial term in the beginning.
Not just curvature.
It's not just curvature. It's an extra term, which tells me about the scale of G. That's absolutely right.
But then there should be one loop correction to just rescaling somehow, which would involve curvature somehow.
It's governed by the same principle, just as an extra term which accounts for the fact that the metric now has a non-trivial.
Yeah, that this, but in Gavinsky's notes actually, I'm now remembering there's an explicit term like that. Maybe it went like that, something like that. Any more questions or discussion? Okay, so we're meeting next on January 12th, if that's a Friday. And I will do a Feynman expansion in a simple example, and then I will leap from the simple example to this example and try to explain how this computation is actually done.